What's in the bag? A shark or something?
Put the bunny back in the box.
Five movies. This is one of your co-hosts, Chris Gasper.
This is Frank Pellicone.
You were listening to episode 98 of The Quick Cage. Return once again, Frank. Which Cage movie do you have for us tonight?
So tonight we're going to talk about 2023's Dream Scenario. It's described alternately as a comedy thriller and a black comedy fantasy. I would call it a light psychological horror movie. I think there's enough like horror elements that it probably falls more in that vein, in my opinion. It's directed by a guy named Christopher Borgli. He's directed some other stuff, but I don't know his other movies really. Stars Cage, Julianne Nicholson, Michael Cera, Tim Meadows, Dylan Baker, bunch of other like minor cast members that you would recognize immediately. Nicholas Braun, I guess. Lily Gow, I don't know. There's a bunch of them.
Sure.
So the premise of the movie is that Nicholas Cage is kind of this weak-willed college professor. He absolutely like bows everything like to his wife, including taking her name because it just quote unquote made more sense. Doesn't really have the respect of the community that he's an expert in, which is like bioscience kind of. Nobody really pays attention during his lectures. He's just kind of a schlub.
Sure.
You also find out pretty early on that there was a woman that he went to grad school with who is apparently taking ideas that he had in grad school and writing a book about them. Although she denies that she's stolen from him when he asks, they meet for coffee and he asks for basically just like credit in her book, like thanks to or whatever. But she declines that she's like using any of his ideas. One of which is ant-telligence, because he talks about like the brilliance of like ant hives and whatever.
So this guy's Walter White. He just teaches bio rather than chem.
He's actually probably more ineffectual than Walter White.
Okay.
And Cage plays him like an absolute like schlub kind of, but like a genial schlub. Like he's not a guy that you hate, you know, it's just somebody that maybe you kind of would feel bad for or whatever.
Right.
So then all of a sudden, people start connecting that all these different people start connecting with each other that they're dreaming about him. And what they're dreaming is him basically just like being a nothing in their dreams. Like they're having like a dream about whatever. I mean, there's one woman's dreaming about like this giant earthquake in the school cafeteria, and he just kind of wanders in and stares at her and doesn't like help anybody. There's a guy that's dreaming that, he's like going through this like field and there's this like giant tall man that's chasing him, and Nicolas Cage appears and he's more concerned with like the mushrooms on a tree, and he basically causes the tall man to like catch up with him and kill him. Just generally like people dream that Nicolas Cage is kind of ineffectual. So sort of mirroring like his real life, but with no explanation for why like they're all dreaming about him. So the more people connect those dots, the more sort of notoriety Cage gets. To the point where he becomes like a global viral celebrity for this thing. So on one hand, he's kind of flattered and fascinated by the idea of being this like celebrity. But on the other hand, he's annoyed at the fact that the thing that's making him famous is something that he has no control over and has nothing to do with, you know, what he's actually knowledgeable and successful in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So You realize kind of early on that his wife has this like flirtatious relationship with a guy that she works with. And then maybe she sort of like fantasizes about this guy. Cage goes away at one point to meet with, Michael Cera plays this head of a marketing agency. So Cage goes to meet with Michael Cera to talk about like, sort of like advertising opportunities and ways to market his celebrity. While he's there, Michael Cera's young assistant kind of flirts with him a little bit. She offers to take him out to drinks, but he's like, no, I'm married. But then when he calls his wife, he realizes that she's alone with this in their house with this dude that, you know, he has this like latent jealousy of. So he ends up going out to drinks with the girl, and she admits that the dreams that she's been having with him are where they have sex, and they're really graphic. So it's the first time anyone's told him about a dream where he's actually done anything. So they end up going back and attempting to have sex, and he, when she tries to undo his belt, he farts, and then that's awkward. And then she tries to undo his belt again, and he ejaculates in his pants and then farts. So it's like just really embarrassing. So, so that night he's super angry at himself, you know, not only for not being able to perform with this like attractive young lady who is definitely into the idea of having sex with him, but also the idea that his wife might be cheating on him and she doesn't find him attractive. And he's really angry during the meeting with Michael Cera because they want him to appear in people's dreams holding a Sprite, like, so they can advertise Sprite inside the dreams. Like, that's the next realm of like advertisement is this dream advertisement. And maybe they can get him in with Obama so they can like up his cachet. And all he wants to do is publish his fucking book about intelligence. So after he, you know, kind of fails with the girl and has this bad experience, all of a sudden people start dreaming about him, like basically becoming like a serial killer, like murdering. All of his students start having these dreams where he's like choking them to death or bludgeoning them to death with a hammer. I'll tell you that this part of the movie, and this is like the darkest part. It gets dark here and then stays pretty dark throughout, until the ending, which is maybe a little bit like light. Really makes me super excited to see that Long Legs movie and see him in an actual horror role, because he's fucking like menacing and terrifying as what I would call like a dream stalker kind of thing, you know, like just almost like a Michael Myers-esque like mindless brute, like stalking people through their dreams and killing them.
Interesting.
And I think that it must be like, it's probably going to be amazing to see him like really embrace that as a serial killer, because he's got this like way about him that's just cold and inhuman almost, like in that part of the movie. Not in general, but just like when in that dream scenario.
Sure.
So his big popularity that he gained is now gone because everybody hates him. Students don't want to come to his class. And the problem is he's so egotistical, I guess, like self-deprecating, but egotistical. It's a really bad combination in terms of the personality, but he can't get over the fact that somehow, like, he doesn't understand that people dreaming about him murdering them might be uncomfortable for them. He's just like, well, it's not my fault, so why should I change anything about my life? So he gets like increasingly more isolated from everyone else. His wife ends up kicking him out after he gets in a physical altercation with a guy at a restaurant because no one wants to eat in the restaurant with them because they're uncomfortable. Tim Meadows plays the dean of his college that he's a teacher at. And they're best friends, but he ends up suspending him because the students like just can't have class with him. They all like are really afraid of him, kind of. He ends up getting banned from seeing his daughter perform in this play that she's in. And when he goes to like kind of try and force his way in, because again, he doesn't understand that it's about his daughter, like, you know, and not about him like being there to see his daughter, but he can't get over the fact that it might make people uncomfortable for him to be there. So he like causes a teacher to get injured by trying to force his way into the auditorium. And so then it's, you know, Paul Mitchell or whatever his name is. Paul Matthews, assaults like teacher at school or whatever. So him and the wife get separated. He's kind of like, Sarah is still representing him, so I guess they signed a contract, although that's never really implicitly mentioned. But now the only thing he can get is gigs like touring in France at the Rue Morgue, as kind of like a sideshow attraction. Mm-hmm. And he writes a book about his experiences that he wants to call Dream Scenario, but they end up titling it like I Am Your Nightmare or something like that. So after the teacher assault thing, he really kind of just disappears. Where no one like knows what's happened to him, but this company has created this device that you can wear that lets people enter your dreams and that you can use to enter other people's dreams that they use for marketing. So they just have this group of influencers who like pop into your dream and they're like, all of a sudden you're wearing like fancy shoes or they're hyping up like muscle stimulants or whatever. But Cage is using it to try and get back into his wife's dreams so she can fall in love with him again. And that's just kind of where the movie ends, is him like finally appearing in her dream and rescuing her from something and them just kind of like being in love. So,
okay.
Yeah, so that's it. It's the movie.
So, yeah, okay. Some of this makes things I've heard make a lot more sense now that I've heard the plot. So what'd you think of it?
I really enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. I would say it's probably top 10 Cage, maybe.
Okay.
Or right up there. It made me really uncomfortable in a Curb Your Enthusiasm kind of way many times. Mm. Especially because he's not like deplorable or, you know, you don't hate him, but you're just so annoyed at how like ineffectual and like weird, and I don't know, the fact that he's got like all this, it really is like the Walter White scene where he goes to confront the old colleague who's now wealthy about the shared credit for their project or whatever. I don't really remember exactly how that plays out in Breaking Bad, but it's very similar to that.
Mm-hmm.
But then, like, you sort of start to, you really don't feel for him for a while because he just doesn't get, like, it's actually probably a really good analogy for boomers, maybe? I don't know, like, how else to say that. Like, I don't want to use that term necessarily, but where it's all these young people that just don't relate to him and he doesn't understand why, like, he needs to distance himself from the people that he makes uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Like that his, and it's his presence, you know, and it's not necessarily that he's wrong, but he doesn't get the fact that he's making like these people uncomfortable to be around. And oh, there's this terrible fucking scene where he makes a viral video where he like basically apologizes for what's happening, but then says that he's the victim in it.
Mm-hmm.
Like that if anyone has suffered, it's him because he mm-hmm. didn't ask for that to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And how he's had a dream where he stalked himself. And now like he's fuck, what is it, like lived the experience or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh. Anyway, yeah, so there's that.
Yeah.
So it's a really great performance by him. It's pretty subtle and nuanced and kind of veers, you know, again between like a cringy like milquetoast and some actual like animal ferocity, like when he gets like really angry. He eventually finds out that the woman that he had accused of sort of plagiarizing his work had legitimately plagiarized his work and is calling it Antelligence, which she swore that like she was never going to use. And like after he has that, like all these people start dreaming about him, like again, like murdering and raping them, and it's just yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. It's well directed. I didn't think it overstayed its welcome too much. Again, it's uncomfortable, but you know, it kind of veers between some sentimentality and some horror and comedy. I laughed out loud 3 or 4 times, I guess. So I don't know that I think it's like, that's why I think it's more of like a light psychological horror as opposed to a comedy. Because I don't think a lot of the movie is necessarily super funny, but it's just, it's well done and good performance and definitely worth watching.
Yeah. They played it up much more as a comedy in the trailer. I remember, I thought at least anyway, like that it was a, yes, drama.
I don't know. I mean, I guess it depends on what you laugh at maybe. So if you, I guess if you're really into Schadenfreude in terms of like just seeing someone absolutely like fall apart. I mean, it's like Job-esque, you know, not like, what's it called? Arrested Development Job, but like, you know,
right,
Pillar of Salt Job.
Yeah.
And just the amount of like things that happen to this guy one after another that are just like testing him as a human being. And by the end of the movie that he still is trying to maintain some sort of positivity and trying to win his wife back and, you know, really just trying to sort of change himself and be a more decent person. You really do kind of feel some empathy for him at the end. And it's like, I think it's an earned empathy, you know, like I really felt like I truly understood him as a human being by the end of the movie. So, yeah, the thing on the couch with the girl that made me laugh out loud. And that was more just because like, there's no hint of like scatological or physical like humor up to that point, really, or at least not like that, like that base, like, you know, body function humor. And right. Then for it to happen and her reaction and his reaction is just like, it's pretty fucking funny. Like it was like a like laugh, like, oh my God.
Right. I can see that.
But yeah, I don't know. I thought it was really good. I think it's definitely worth seeing. Again, so I would argue, just thinking off the top of my head, that it's a top 10 Cage movie of all time in terms of like both its artistry and its enjoyment factor, something, whatever.
Okay. This the because I like, you know, get Cage shit in my feed all the time. The thing that I would hear a lot about this movie was, and I didn't even look it up on Rotten Tomatoes here, but that it was criticized a lot for being a kind of, how would I summarize it, a reductive look at cancel culture.
You know, that's interesting that you say it like that, because I think it's only reductive if you feel seen, maybe. I don't know like how else to say it, but if you feel like that's you, kind of. Because in my opinion, he comes off as the being canceled comes off as like his own fault in a lot of ways because of how his reaction to everything was. Like, because he tried to take the fame and parlay it into a book deal to write his book about, you know, intelligence, when all anybody wanted to do was talk about the fact that he was in their dreams. And then the second that he switches from being like this weak-willed but loyal man, just because like he doesn't even like know for sure that his wife's cheating on him, he just is jealous and insecure and tries to sleep with like the woman that's 30 years younger than him or whatever, and immediately fails. Like, that's when everything goes crazy because he's got all this like pent up energy. So the canceling portion ends up becoming his own fault. Like, even though he never admits that he tried to sleep with the assistant or whatever, it's 100% like that's the catalyst for it becoming, you know, like everything going bad for him. And it's 100% his fault. So I don't know that I don't view it as reductive. I view it as probably telling to people who should maybe feel a little more guilty about the way that they react towards people just trying to have like feelings and opinions, you know?
Interesting. Yeah,
I mean, we make that fun of, like, cancel culture, and I hate the way that people use the term woke now, but that whole idea that, like, just having some empathy and compassion towards someone's, like, cultural beliefs or deeply held feelings.
Sure.
In a way, just to kind of protect their feelings when you're interacting with them. You know, on like a human one-to-one level.
Right. Just be a human being, you know.
Right. Just treat people decent, because it's not hard to do that. And
right.
Just keep your fucking opinions to yourself, kind of thing.
Sure.
It's like every time that it's always about him and what it's done to him and how hard it is for him. And
yeah, how you described it, it sounded much more nuanced than some of like the
criticism
than that I heard of it. I think the main thrust of that criticism probably is coming from the idea of like he's being judged subjectively by people that don't actually know him through, you know, through the dream, like, you know, analogy.
I mean, but part of that too is that I think it's, I actually, like, nuanced is the right way to put it. It really is like a look at both sides of the idea of cancel culture and the fact that you might deserve to be canceled sometimes because of your actions, but you might also deserve a chance at redemption and forgiveness because of your actions, you know, like people can contain multitudes or whatever.
Sure.
And they can be like, you know, complex individuals that might do something wrong, but might also like be worthy of a second chance. So I don't know. I think that's actually kind of the whole point of the movie, is that you can learn from your mistakes and you can grow as a person and maybe still deserve to be happy, even if you've made a mistake that's like hurt someone or,
sure,
you know, affected them negatively.
Yeah. I mean, it's a conversation that I feel, make sure I don't get canceled here. I think it's a conversation that many people on the left are uncomfortable about having. In my experience, at least anyway, like at least in like kind of like mainstream media and like even some people I know, about that idea, like of what happens after someone's committed a sin, an act, whatever, that like leads to this. And I don't even like the idea of cancel culture, but it's like, you know, when somebody's held responsible in some way publicly for something like that. I find a lot of people on the left don't want to have the conversation about like, where does that person go for the rest of their life?
Sure.
I hear that on the right, or like, you know, libertarian kind of side of things at times, or, you know, which anymore to me, libertarians are really just like, you know, people that don't want to say they're right wing, But I hear that conversation happening there. Of course, it's biased and skewed, you know, just like, you know, some of the stuff on the left is biased and skewed. But I don't hear liberals talking about that, really. But it's a valid point, you know. I mean, so somebody does something, and it could be that the answer is yes, like they're done. Like they're done in that field or something like that. But it's like, you know, I can't remember who it was. There was a restaurateur, like famous one. I can't remember who it was that got caught up during Me Too. And it's like he ended up having to like resign from his restaurant, like, you know, big restaurant business. And
you talking about
like,
Mario Batali?
Yeah. That's him. Yeah, I don't pay attention to those people. And what, he had to step down as CEO basically, or like whatever that position is. That
he lost his Food Network television show, and yeah, he lost like some position.
Yeah, in his restaurant.
I'm not going to say exactly what happened, but there was like definitely some negative repercussions.
Yeah.
Because he got accused of being a sex pest, basically.
Sure. And it seemed like he probably was, right? Like, you know, so it's like, at that point, like, publicly, there has to be some decision that's made, like, in the sense of, like, you know, but it's like, can this guy not, I mean, that's what he is, right? He's a chef. Like, he's a restaurateur. Like, so it's a valid question to ask. Is this guy allowed to ever be that ever again?
So, of course he can be a chef. He just might not be a world-famous chef on television.
Sure.
That's the difference. Like,
except for maybe, I mean, is he still? Like, I don't know.
Yeah, that dude is cooking somewhere and making a lot of money doing it.
Yeah.
It just might not be in the spotlight. Here's my answer to what you're saying, because I agree with what you're saying. But the problem is the way that it's approached by people that can be so right and so wrong at the same time is that it takes people that you could teach a lesson to and make them better people, and it radicalizes them in the opposite direction that you want. And that is what causes all the problems we have now, is that forced radicalization, because those people feel like they have nowhere to go but all the way to the right.
Right.
And the right plays into it by being like, oh, we're accepting, you know, sure, we understand you. And all they want to do is like cut out your womb and fucking keep you in the
goddamn. Hold on a second. Gotta write something down. I'm just joking.
In any event.
Yeah. Like,
If we could be compassionate people and understanding that everyone is going to be a different person from you, and people are going to say stupid things and do stupid things, and
yeah, and there's a big difference obviously between saying something stupid and acts, you know.
Yeah,
you know, okay. There's a difference between, and then it's like conversations again, like, you know, like that is, you do hear more of that like on the left, I suppose, and on the right obviously, but and there's a difference between like comedians and just regular people, right? It's like, you know, at the same time, like, you know, I do, it's like, it's one thing for Ricky Gervais to make anti-trans remarks versus, you know, I don't know, assaulting a trans person, right? I mean, and this movie feels like it's sticking more towards maybe thought than it is acts. Is that correct?
Because the idea is that you cannot mean to hurt someone and still hurt them, and to not understand that that hurt still exists whether you meant it or not,
mm-hmm,
is an important way of like moving forward. Like,
right,
it isn't until he's completely he's not in anyone's dreams anymore, because he's lost all of his ego at that point, basically. And just realize that he's lost his wife, and that's the thing that mattered to him. Like, that's when he's able to move on. So,
mm-hmm,
you know, just because you don't think it hurts someone's feelings to whatever, like say the wrong pronouns or mm-hmm use their dead name or
yeah
use some minor slur that you don't think is offensive, but whatever, that just shows that you're self-absorbed and fuck you, you know, like you got to learn how to,
right,
I don't know, whatever, just be a good person, right, treat people with respect. It's super simple,
right,
unless they're useless, and then treat them like a useless fuck, because some people are useless. But
what was that disc score again?
Don't talk about my disc assessment on the fucking quick cage.
What do you know, like, where this like general premise comes from? Like, have we talked about this? No, not this. The dream scenario premise.
I read it and I don't remember.
Okay. I didn't know if you were familiar with it, because it pops up a lot of times on YouTube for all of my like fucking creepy, you know, paranormal sci-fi stuff of like the, it's called like This Man or Have You Seen This Man, like meme. It's all bogus and it was a hoax. It was like some kind of sociologist doing like kind of like a study, but it was around for a while in like the late alts, in terms of like, you know, this picture of this guy, like, you know, it's like, have you seen this man in your dream? And people would come in and say like, I have seen that guy, like, because it was like almost like a sociological, psychological like test to see if people like, you know, could be influenced through suggestion. But it was still like, it's still like an interesting story, like to some degree, like based on like all like the theories people started to develop that like believed in all of this. But that they just like they use that general premise for this movie, like the idea that ever this guy appearing in everybody's dreams and stuff like that. Anybody that's interested in that kind of stuff, it is an interesting like story. Like look up a YouTube video or something like that. So what's your scores here for the movie and for the Cage performance?
The movie's a solid 8. I thought it was well done. I don't think it's like an instant classic or anything, but I think it's definitely worth watching. Cage is a 9. It's not my favorite performance of his, but parts of it did get me excited to like see a couple of his future things. What is that? There's another movie that's coming out like soon that he stars in, but I can't remember what it is. I don't recall it being. It's like Monsters or something. It's almost like A Quiet Place meets They Come at Night meets something else. Do you know what I'm talking about? Him and his two sons are like in a post-apocalyptic world where there's monsters outside.
No, I don't think I've seen that.
Altavan or Altrian or sign on that.
Oh, Arcadian.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you. That I'm naming the... like fucking like psych drugs.
Yeah, Arcadian. Yeah, that is another hard action horror that he's in. I had not heard a premise for that movie yet because as long as we've been like, you know, referencing that movie through like I think the end of the initial Quick Cage run, maybe it was on his schedule. There's never been a synopsis and they're still not actually on Wikipedia. No.
There's a trailer for it now.
Is there? Oh, okay. Yeah, because that has one of the It kids, right?
But I don't remember.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's the trailer's okay. It's not my kind of movie necessarily. It's not the horror that I enjoy, but
yeah.
I'll watch it just well, I mean, obviously because I have to, but
yeah, I mean that and Long Legs is supposed. I mean, is this year?
Long Legs is July, and I think that Arcadia movie is. It seemed like it was
theatrical release April 12th. And then followed by a streaming release on Shudder. So,
I started watching a movie on Shudder today. I know this is not the point of the Quick Cage, and I really hated it, and I turned it off. And it's one of the few times that I've done that recently. Where I just said, I'm not fucking watching this movie, and I stopped watching it. So
good for you.
It's called Megalomania.
Okay.
Or Megalomaniac, maybe. It's based on like a true story about a serial killer in Belgium, of all places. But man, did I fucking hate it. Like 15, 20 minutes in.
You shouldn't have to take their shit, man. Fuck it. Just turn your off.
I do what I want.
Oh, let's see. So then he also has next year The Surfer, and that's the only other movie that he has on his upcoming filmography right now. Plays a man, it's a psychological thriller, plays a man who returns to Australia to buy back his family home after many years in the US, but is humiliated in front of his teenage son by a group of local surfers who claim ownership over the secluded beach of his childhood.
Sounds great.
Yeah. Julian McMahon is in it. That was in Nip Tuck and played Dr. Doom in the Fantastic Four movies from the 2000s.
Right. I just want to see Long Legs, and yeah. I wish it was in July when it comes out. So
right. So there's something I referenced on the last Quick Cage that we did back in December that I had back then, but I know that you're not a huge fan of like knowing things about people because you're not about people, you're about things and you're about dominating and influencing things specifically.
More dominating than influencing.
Yes. But I do think this is a really interesting family like kind of like story that I didn't know anything about in terms of like the Coppola family whatsoever. And when I got this in my feed and I read it, I was like, oh shit, like this is like Shakespearean like to some degree. And I think it might give you, and I don't think it impacts Nick Cage's performances necessarily, but I think it impacts Cage as a person in some of this. And it's just, so I'm being ethical here, it was an article written by Zach Schoenfeld called "On the Jealous Rivalry Between Nick Cage and His Uncle Francis Ford Coppola." And the general premise of the article is the idea, like at the beginning, like, you know, is that Francis Ford Coppola starts struggling in the 80s and starts like just putting out like teenage movies and stuff like that, like, you know, because he has like basically he starts failing in Hollywood and needs to make money. And as a result of like him having to do these things, he like almost inadvertently gives Cage a platform to rise in Hollywood as he's faltering. Is the general premise, but it ends up going into the background of the Coppola family, and this is what I find super interesting. So I'm going to try to summarize a lot of this and just read some key excerpts, especially from Cage himself, of his memories and thoughts and stuff. So the Cage's father is August Floyd Coppola, and he is the older brother of Francis Ford Coppola. August Floyd is wanted to become the it was a professor and wanted to become the great American novelist from a young age. And Francis Ford always looked up to August. In fact, the reason that like Francis Ford uses the middle name is because August used Floyd when he wrote, and it was August Floyd Coppola, like on his novels and stuff like that and his short stories. So Francis Ford Coppola started using his middle name as a screenwriter, and director. Francis Coppola saw himself as becoming a playwright and his brother the novelist, but ended up going into screenwriting more because there was more financial viability there. So the problem is, though, is that Cage's father, August, is not a very successful novelist, whatsoever. And despite like, you know, and has a modest income as a professor. So he's raising his kids on like an academic, you know, salary. His wife was like, Cage's mother was actually very sick and often hospitalized. They ended up divorcing in 76, his parents. And August like ends up like pouring himself even more into becoming a novelist and kind of resents the idea of screenplays. In meanwhile, Francis Coppola makes The Godfather and The Godfather 2 in The Conversation and wins 2 Oscars. And as a result of that, and like has like Talia Shire, like another Coppola in the movie. And like, you know, the person who does the score for The Godfather is a Coppola. And like, you know, he ends up getting like, you know, an Oscar and all this acclaim. So like Francis ends up like, you know, bringing up a bunch of Coppolas. His like August resents all of this. And pours himself into becoming like, again, the great American novelist. So he ends up writing this experimental erotic novel called The Intimacy. It's about a man and a woman who choose to live in total darkness in search of, quote, a rehabilitation of the soul, end quote. The book was a culmination of the professor's obsession with touch, and it was filled with passages of gooey erotic exploration. Here's a typical sentence. He pumped all the harder, his testicles slamming up against her, his temples aching. Apparently the book was a hit with like the female readers of August Coppola, but had sold fewer than 2,000 copies from 1978 to 1985. It ends up being his last novel. He sticks to just like teaching primarily. During this time, the Chris Coppola, Cage's brother, and Cage were on and off again living with August while he was like, you know, like writing this book. And August was convinced this was going to be the thing that like made him bigger than his brother. Absolutely convinced of it. So meanwhile, like, you know, fucking Francis has like a 22-room Victorian mansion in San Francisco, Manhattan apartment, you know, like fucking Napa Valley property, like, you know, all this shit, like a vineyard. So Cage grows up himself as, how's it written here? As a visitor, never a belonger to the Francis Coppola side of the family. So he's always around Francis Coppola and his kids and that kind of stuff. And starts himself to take on his father's perception and starts to resent Francis Ford Coppola and his wealth in a lot of ways through his own self-admission. So they would spend summers there, you know, and stuff like that. The kids had a screening room in Francis's house, and Cage would watch movies. He even attended an early screening of Apocalypse Now, like down, you know, in the theater room. Apparently the thing that really kind of convinces him to become an actor in some ways, in part, is that during that screening, he ends up having a conversation with Dennis Hopper, about the movie, and he was so impressed with Hopper, like, you know, talking about movies and art and acting and all that kind of stuff. Like, Cage basically from that moment on decides he's going to become an actor, through this experience. So here's a few stories that Cage himself has told about his relationship and like his memories of like growing up around that and like his subsequent reactions. So around 12 or 13, he was in the backseat of Francis's car. Coppola was driving over the Golden Gate Bridge, listening to the Beatles song, Baby, You're a Rich Man. I was thinking, this is Cage speaking. I was thinking, yeah, he really deserves to listen to this, doesn't he? Cage later told a writer, he was right at the height of Godfather 2, and I vowed to myself that one day I'd be able to listen to that song too as a reward to myself. So when Valley Girl becomes a hit, Cage fulfills this wish by taking his Triumph Spitfire for a joyride on Sunset Boulevard and singing along to the song. Story two that he tells, another car arrived at Coppola in the late 70s. Cage told his uncle, if you want to see acting, give me a screen test and I'll show you acting. His uncle ignored him and for years refused to give him a role whatsoever in any of his movies. Cage and his father were at his uncle's house. August and Coppola were talking about something about James Joyce supposedly said about Ibsen. And Joyce told Ibsen that you were great, but I hold the mantle now. Years later, after Valley Girl, Cage was at his uncle's house again. He says that Francis Ford Coppola was lighting a cigar. And I just said to him, you were great, Francis, but I hold the mantle now. Apparently, this got like Francis Ford and Coppola like extremely upset at this. Cage has insisted these stories are true, although they're not confirmed by Francis Ford Coppola. But they feel like origin myths, according to the article, peeks into the damaged psyche of someone who grew up hungry and ambitious in the shadow of an artist whose ambitions were fulfilled beyond anyone's imagining. Christopher Coppola, the brother, reflects, we were the Southern Coppolas, sometimes called the poor Coppolas by people, because we weren't rich like Francis Ford and his family. Nick, he's talking about here, had a lot of anger. He wanted to make it big, and he did so because he was goal-oriented. Cage himself says that he was really upset by like the wealth, and says that I think I turned myself into Heathcliff, referencing Wuthering Heights.
Yes.
So it gives you a little, because we talk about this fucking dude for 98 episodes now in some way or another, right? And it's like he's Nick Cage, and we always have referenced the idea, everybody, most people know he's a Coppola and stuff like that. But it gets to the heart here of who this guy is in changing his name. This guy resents like this divide in his family so much that like he refused to take on the name Coppola for all this and wanted to make his own name distant from the Coppola name out of this because of some sort of resentment towards Francis Ford Coppola. And in some ways, given what becomes of Francis Ford Coppola later in life in terms of his career and like got him getting exposed in some ways, kind of makes me like Nick Cage a little bit more.
I mean, I like him fine anyway. I don't know. I didn't like hearing any of the things you just told me.
I just find it a really fascinating psychodrama that's going on inside of this guy's mind. As like he turns into like a crazy person, right? Like, I mean, like, think about all the shit that we've talked about when I went through like the list in previous episodes of the stupid, crazy money he spent. And like, what is the whole reason we're doing this podcast? The whole reason we're doing this podcast is because he spent so much fucking money and had to make bad movies. That's why we're doing it. This
podcast is I had the misfortune to watch Knowing one night.
Exactly. And that's one of those movies.
Sitting on my couch. I mean, not the unfortunate, because I actually enjoy The Quick Cage.
Yes.
And I'm excited when it comes up. But I don't know. I don't know. Why do you want to know things about people? Like, it doesn't help you at all.
Doesn't it?
No. None of that stuff will change any way that I look at any single Nick Cage movie ever. I don't care. Oh, my God. A rich guy.
It's the totality. It's the totality of the person in the career.
No. It doesn't matter. I don't give two shits about somebody's personal life. If I know about your personal life, I'm more likely to not want to like know anything about your career or like watch your movies. I'd rather just enjoy my life. Live life to the lees, Chris.
You want immediate results.
I do.
Yes. And that's all you care about is those immediate results.
Well, why do you have to dig into shit, you fucking see? Like,
you know what I find hilarious? What is it? The one website when I took that disc thing used the term compliance, which is your fucking language. That's that supervisor language, of like how you can control people is compliance, where other things call it conscientiousness, like other disc assessments. So I see.
Yeah, you do see. You just fucking see.
I see what y'all are doing.
You know what you want? You just want to have someone to tell you what to do so you can do what you're told. So, I don't know.
I don't know. I'm not necessarily doing what I'm told now.
Aren't you?
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know. I don't feel like it benefits me at all to
know about anybody.
Yeah, I mean, people I know in the real world, like, is fine. I like to know about real human beings, but Nicolas Cage is not a real human being. He's a cartoon character to entertain me. So I started reading that biography.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to know that shit either. I stopped. Best decision I ever made.
Yeah.
Well,
I think... Huh?
I've made better decisions, but it's a real
toss up, right?
I make good decisions every day.
Right. Yes. We'll talk about one of those this coming Monday on the Spin Chagrin, as normal. Every Monday, Spin Chagrin. We are now on episode 112 of that. By the end of this year, it seems we will complete 100 episodes of The Quick Cage. And as always, you can check out the primary podcast. Our next episode coming up will be a continuation of our Saul journey, which that's a decision that could have been better made.
You ain't getting there.
Thanks for listening to this tonight, and thanks for continuing to support us.
Deuces.